You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Björn Conrad of the Global Public Policy Institute in Berlin, and I'm going to have the pleasure today to lead through this event a little bit and moderate the proceedings. Welcome again. We are delighted to have all of you here for the launch of the final report of the Working Group on Climate Governance of the Global Governance 2020 program. You all found the report on your seats, and if not, then we have a couple more copies here. Also, most of you have hopefully helped yourself to lunch. It's also going to be there afterwards, so we can get some more lunch then. The group, part of which you see in front here, and the other part you see seated here, please wave that everyone knows where you are. The group started their work thinking about the future of global climate governance right after the Copenhagen negotiations. And the frustration of that experience actually for the group turned out to be an amazing source of creativity and innovation. They have the framework for the thought process that they have started a year ago and have finished now has been a mixture of scenario planning methodology and trend analysis that helped them to actively challenge standard pattern of thinking and to adapt a more proactive instead of a reactive approach to finding pathways into the future of global governance. And I think this innovative momentum, I think it's fair to say that the group back then at the beginning of 2010 was among the first to really systematically think about a plan B, about effective actions to be taken over the course of the next decades in the absence of a global deal. The group will now start to present their findings. We have Jin, Tom, and André presenting different parts of the report for about 10 minutes, I would say. And then we have invited a wonderful group of panelists set up front here, and they will come up here after, and I will introduce them then to share some of their thoughts with us. And well, you probably all, when you came here, you probably all thought, well, you're going to come here and lean back and have lunch and hear a bit of smart thinking about global climate governance, and we're going to deliver on all of these issues. But in fact, we would also like you to have a much more active role in all this. The process that the group has been going through is now at a crucial point where they have elaborated and laid out their vision of how a plan B can look like, but there's still a whole lot of open questions and loose ties about how this can become reality. So we are hoping from you to get as much input and as much thoughts as possible on what you will be hearing right now. So with that, I'm going to turn over to Jin, and we're going to start.
Thank you, Björn. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for coming today. We are both pleased and honored to have this opportunity to speak with you all, to present our ideas and to listen to your own. Today we are going to suggest that we change the way we think, talk, and act on mitigating climate change, away from a make or break UN-sponsored global treaty towards a UN-plus approach. This means turning from a global treaty to the world's climate leaders. This climate leaders include national and subnational governments, companies, communities, NGOs, and so on. These climate leaders can make their own progress to reduce GHG emissions in the coming decade. What we can do is to support, catalyze, and coordinate these climate leaders. A reform of the global governance is needed to strengthen this patchwork approach. We believe, in short, there need to be a recognition of common but differential responsibilities within countries as well as among them. So we believe the UN Plus approach is the most pragmatic and feasible method and approach for way to move ahead. So, Thomas, your turn.
This UN Plus approach that Jin describes emerges from the scenario planning methodology that Bjorn mentioned at the beginning. And in that methodology, we look at the actors, factors, turning points, and trends that shape the future of climate governance. From that emerge three scenarios, which we have listed up on this slide and also in the reports in front of you. These scenarios, in our view, describe the full range of possibilities for the future of climate governance, and they also, and this is a crucial point, highlight two windows of opportunity for different actors to shape those trends and shape the future of climate governance. So let me walk you through them briefly. Our first scenario, at the top, is Kyoto 2.0. This is a world of increasing consensus around the necessity of binding emission cuts through a series of progressively stronger global treaties. To have this vision fall into place, we think of several factors need to be in place. First, weather disasters that concentrate public opinion on the cost of climate change, ambitious corporations developing low-carbon business models that attract investment, seeking first-mover advantages, and governments, militaries shifting to think about the security impacts of climate change as they relate to resource scarcity, population movements, and this kind of thing. The most crucial factor, though, we identify, is the behavior of the United States and China. These two, the G2, have, we think, the ability to radically re-energize climate governance through a series of ambitious steps, setting off a cycle in which ambition begets ambition and makes a global deal possible. However, that first window of opportunity you have listed here is, in our view, all but closed. The domestic politics in both countries lead us to that conclusion. So instead, we see as much more probable our second scenario, which we call stalemate. This is a world of climate governance in ruins, where the UN FCCC process unravels under increasing acrimony, or at least is reduced to a very low, modest level of ambition. It's a world where markets don't receive a signal to invest in clean technology. It's a world where other kinds of concerns, economic issues, unemployment, security issues take the international agenda away from climate change. It's a world where business-as-usual institutions lead to business-as-usual emissions, meaning we're going to have catastrophic changes in global temperatures. This bleak picture, however, is not inevitable. There's a second window of opportunity that the scenario planning methodology identifies. And this is a window of opportunity that can, we think, with the UN Plus approach, lead us to what we call the patchwork governance scenario, in which a broad coalition of actors, countries certainly, but also regions, states, cities, provinces, non-state actors like civil society groups, corporations, take specific individual actions that somehow add up to more than the sum of their parts. This is already happening. Probably everyone in this room can think of several examples. Maybe many people in this room have been involved with many examples of these kinds of bottom-up, civil society-led, subnational government-led initiatives. To cite just one example, we can think about the bilateral talks going on today between the United States and China. On the side of the state visit is a U.S. Energy Climate Summit in which these kinds of bilateral, bottom-up, type 2 type initiatives are very much on the agenda. But we also know that these kinds of efforts are not enough, that these bottom-up initiatives have not to date reached the level of scope and ambition where they'll actually make a difference for the global climate to the extent needed. Therefore, the key question for policymakers, the one that our scenario planning methodology really highlights, is how to make these things work, how to bring them to the level of scale and ambition will they be able to bring us from the bad scenario, the scenario two, to the patchwork scenario, and possibly even the future back up to the place where a global deal is possible.
Thank you, Tom. I would now like to talk you through a couple of the recommendations that our group has been working on. So, to begin with, we see that the first big move is to go beyond this global deal mentality. So if policymakers just continue to put all of their efforts, focus all of their efforts on the international negotiations, they will continue to be frustrated and disappointed. So instead, we argue that we need a complementary or supplementary UN Plus approach. And I would like to outline some of the key actors that we have identified and some of the specific actions they would have to take in order to seize this second window of opportunity. And in fact, I would like to start with the two that are commonly identified as the main obstacles to any progress on global climate change. So let's start with China. So we see China should engage in a very active bottom-up entrepreneurial approach, allowing different actors such as cities, government, regions, companies to commit to binding emissions reductions, because it's exactly this kind of local experimentation that has also founded the Chinese economic boom. So we now see that the richer regions of China should be allowed to move ahead more quickly than others and engage in this kind of initiative, also together, of course, with international peer networks. Now, what about the U.S.? And quite contrary to a common belief, the U.S. is already one of the leaders when it comes to these bottom-up approaches. There are dozens of initiatives at state level and literally hundreds at the city level. They combine about 45% of total U.S. emissions. So to put that into perspective, this equals roughly the emissions of Germany and Japan put together. Now the question really is, how do we get the other 55% on board? And this is where federal leadership can play a crucial role. So faced with the congressional deadlock and also financial and fiscal constraints, we would argue that the federal government can lead, for example, by establishing a baseline of expectations for states to initiate, to tackle, to move on, and start working on climate change issues. Now, we also recognize that not all progress of this UN Plus approach can come from below. So let's talk about the EU as the third key actor. And we feel that the EU needs to step it up as well, because we do see a very powerful role for the EU in shaping up what we call a coalition of the ambitious, of countries that commit to very specific and aggressive emission targets. And this can be done either by diplomatic incentives or sanctions, or even economic incentive and sanctions, including that you could consider something like green space, linking trade and climate policies, and maybe even start talking about carbon cross-border adjustment taxes. Now, having said that, of course, government action can only get us this far. So where does the business community and also civil society come into play? We see that they can lead where governments simply cannot lead anymore. So private sector can commit to specific emission reduction targets, for example, at the firm level, but also at the sectoral and industry level. Now, civil society has the power and the potential to change how we think, frame, and talk about climate change. They have the potential to change the narrative of climate change. And at the same time, very importantly, they can create legitimacy for all initiatives at various levels and not just national governments. Now, having talked about all these various players, various initiatives, we also need a certain set of coherence. And this is where the UN comes back into play. The UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, we do foresee a very important role for them to play in this UN Plus scenario. They could, in fact, act as a clearinghouse for a whole patchwork of different governance approaches, setting standards, defining norms, and also making sure that information is shared between all these initiatives and actors. Now, Jin has talked to you about our general approach, this UN Plus, and Tom has outlined some of these, has outlined our three scenarios. So I would like to summarize our two key findings, or restate our two key findings, and that is that, yes, there is a second window of opportunity, and secondly, there's something what we call the UN Plus approach that we could think about. Now, at the same time, of course, there still are many open questions. This is what we have come up with so far, and we're very much looking forward to the discussion later on. So some of the open questions, for example, could include, how do we get more actors on board? Secondly, also, how do we ensure that all these targets, commitments, ambitions, that this is enough to get us where we have to go. And third, also, how do we monitor? How do we record? How do we add on all these various players and initiatives? How do we bring it all into one? So that's about it for my part. I would now like to hand back to Björn. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the presentation. What we would like to do now would be to first hear from our panelists a little bit of a reaction to this from the point of view of their experience and background, and then afterwards we will open the floor for the larger discussion. For perhaps I would ask the panelists to come up and take a seat here. Indeed. And I'm first of all I would like to welcome and to thank the four panelists for taking the time for joining us today. All of them are very well suited to give insightful comments to what they have heard, and we hope that will help the process process of the group very much. We have first of all Jennifer Morgan, two to my left, who ran a total of three of the biggest and I think most successful climate and energy policy programs. At the moment, she is doing so for the World Resources Institute, and she has been doing so before for E3G of London and the WWF, and as such has become one of the most esteemed, I would say, advisors to many government and NGO players in the climate world, including Tony Blair's Breaking the Climate Deadlock project, and has put out a vast amount of innovative and interesting ideas on global climate governance, and we hope to benefit from that very much. To my left, Adele Morris, who is from Brookings. So she's actually more at home here than we are. She's a policy director for climate and energy economics here at Brookings, is therefore taking a more economics-based view on climate policy, which we very much appreciate to have that perspective as well. She has, as such, has served as senior economist to the President's Council for Economic Advisors, as well as the Treasury and U.S. Congress. We have to the far left to finish up the ladies with the introduction. We have Jennifer Turner, who is the director of the China Environment Forum of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and has worked a lot on with a strong focus on China and China environmental and climate issues, and in that capacity has also worked tirelessly to make something happen that we are also trying to do with the GG 2020 program, to link activities and link expertise and link knowledge specifically between the US and China on climate issues. And last but not least, we have Stephen Hammer, who is the director of the Urban Energy Project at Columbia University. And he is bringing a very distinct perspective, I think, to the table of this panel, and because his background and his work has been on urban energy and climate policies, and he has been publishing and researching vastly on this topic, has been an advisor to vast spectrum of entities, from the EPA to the City of New York to business players, NGOs, on the topic of energy and energy efficiency policies on the urban level. And as we have heard, this subnational aspect features very prominently in the work of the Climate Group, and that's why we are very happy to have him here and get his expertise as well. I would perhaps ask Adele to take a first shot at the presentation and share some of her thoughts. Thanks.
Well, thanks, Bjorn, and thanks for inviting me here to join this distinguished panel. It's a pleasure to be here, and I congratulate the group on their report, and I'm going to provide some feedback on that, but mostly I would just like to thank you for your contribution to thinking about this very important problem of how we get countries together to abate greenhouse gas emissions. I do come at this issue as an economist. My research focuses on the economics of abating greenhouse gas emissions. And my research really leads me to understand the very tight linkages between emissions and economic activity. And essentially what we have to do is unravel the two and grow our economies without growing emissions and indeed reducing them. I also come at this issue as a former lead negotiator for the United States in the talks under the Kyoto Protocol. I was detailed to the State Department, and so I kind of have a negotiator perspective on all of this as well. And having spent many years in the U.S. federal government, some of my comments will tend to channel the U.S. federal government, so apologies in advance. But it's an important perspective, and I think you'll see where I'm coming from. Before I go into my recommendations and your recommendations, I want to do kind of a grisly postmortem on the negotiations so far. I think it's really important to understand why this is one of the most important negotiating challenges we have ever faced as a world community. And I'll start with stating the obvious, that it's costly to abate emissions. If it was cheap and easy, there'd be nothing to really squabble over, right? And so anything that reduces the cost of abating emissions will reduce the contention over addressing global climate change. A couple other key features of this problem help contribute to its intractable nature. One is that if we're going to mitigate emissions, we're accruing costs now, but the benefits might accrue over many decades, even generations from now. So you have this intertemporal problem between the costs and the benefits. And you also have this socioeconomic difference. I mean, the people who are going to be most impacted by climate change are the poor and vulnerable. But the people emitting are the rich, and that's both true within countries and across countries. That makes the challenge both politically difficult internationally, but also within countries. There are so many complications in projecting scenarios, both on the economic side and on the scientific side. And all of these make it a little more difficult to tell a story to constituents about why the costs they're going to accrue are worthwhile and that the benefits actually justify the costs. There are very diverse, even competing interests within the negotiating community. And because there are so many countries involved and they have very diverse economic and political interests, it makes it difficult to even agree on the objectives of the negotiations. And in some cases, there's a tremendous incentive for some to, this is pejorative, but I kind of mean it that way, to lard up the climate negotiations with many, many other objectives that might be worthy, but they complicate the negotiation process. And just to list a few: trade, development aid, human rights, ecosystem protection. All of these things are important and incredibly difficult in and of themselves. But when you layer them on top of a climate negotiation, it's not surprising you don't get very far. So I will leap to some feedback on your report. And I want to congratulate you on really trying to take a hard look at these questions. I really like the scenario analysis. I think that's a fruitful way, and I think you've identified correctly some potential enabling trends for the various outcomes in your scenarios. I agree with you that the second scenario and the third scenario are probably the more likely than the first scenario, and although we all like rosy outcomes, I just don't see the factors in play that would get us there. I think right now we're seeing the makings of both the second and the third scenario. We see elements of stalemate, but we also see elements of this patchwork governance. As for your recommendations, I think here are some thoughts. I believe that many of the things you've listed as your recommendations are probably helpful. Some might even be necessary. I don't see them as sufficient. And so the question is, how do we get from the actions that you've laid out to something that's sufficient? And let me just give you a few thoughts on what I think a way forward, okay? I think we need to start from the perspective of the emitters. And think of these, I think it would be helpful to think of these negotiations as economic negotiations. We've thought about this as an environmental treaty, and we've treated it kind of in the same framework we have in other environmental treaties. My sense is this is not working. I think we need to treat it more like a negotiation around trade or a negotiation around financial market stability and financial contagion and all the other things that get the economic ministries into the conversation. I think too much the negotiations have been left to environment ministries, many of whom have not been supported by their economic ministries. And I think that's had adverse outcomes in the negotiating process. I think it's really helpful to understand why the U.S. takes the position it does. Many countries don't really understand that in our system of government, the only way an agreement can be implemented is if it's endorsed by Congress after the executive branch brings it home. That constrains our executive branch. Also, our negotiating team is representing the entire executive branch. Every ministry is part of the U.S. negotiating position. That makes it a little different than many other delegations who really are there being represented only by their environment ministries. So I think we need a new forum. I think the major economies forum is a good start there. It needs to be smaller. And honestly, I think it needs to exclude parties who are not, whose emissions are not germane to the ultimate objective of reducing emissions. I think mitigation should be the focus of this smaller group. Adaptation, assistance, economic development, and maybe even technology transfer should be in a separate negotiating forum, perhaps still within the UN Framework Convention. The U.S., I think one thing you left out in your recommendations to the U.S., we need to pursue our existing authorities under the Clean Air Act, and I think we need the international community can actually be very supportive to the administration in its efforts to do that. Although I think the international community needs to be a little more aware of its own limitations. I think there's very little the international negotiating process does, or it has actually in practice very little influence on what happens in Congress and the regulatory trajectory in the U.S. So, I mean, we need to keep our expectations modest. And finally, just a little plug for some of our research. We've come out with a couple papers. One is an economic analysis of the Copenhagen commitments. And what we're trying to do here is argue that you should really compare the efforts and try to understand the international spillovers likely as a result of an international climate agreement. And then finally, a piece called Achieving Comparable Effort Through Carbon Price Agreements. We would argue that the negotiations historically have been around targets and timetables, but that's at least one or two steps removed from the actual effort that goes into complying with the agreement. We think that parties should be allowed to negotiate directly on effort, and that an example of that would be through the negotiating around a price on carbon. And that would give, I think, countries a certain amount more certainty as to the economic burdens that they would face in achieving their commitments. And I'd be more than happy to discuss any of this in the Q&A.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much, Adele. Jennifer, would you like to go next?
So thank you for inviting me here, and thank you for taking the time after Copenhagen, when many of us were still probably trying to figure out what had happened and the lessons from it, to think through a really thoughtful set of scenarios and a response. I thought what I'd do is share some reflections on kind of functions that I think need to be performed in an international regime, and then look at who can do that and some of the recommendations and try and answer your questions in 5 to 7 minutes. So if I think about functions of an international agreement, and if I particularly try and look at the UN, I think one function is ambition. We have a collective problem, and one of the roles of a UN agreement has been, and the Cancun agreements do currently include a 2 degrees goal, not binding, but so where does the ambition, the collective ambition discussion happen is one question. Where do the issues around equity get addressed? This is a fundamentally incredibly driven inequitable process that is occurring where those who aren't contributing to the problem really at all in many cases are the most impacted. That is a collective action problem and needs to be addressed somewhere, and I think that's important. The issue of justice, where does everyone have a voice? So, and thinking about the functions there, important to get countries together who are the big emitters to consider their shared challenges, but where do the most vulnerable have a voice? They're not in the major economies forum, and they are the ones who are really facing no longer existing. Transparency and comparability. I think transparency is pretty easy one to think about. So if you look at any international agreement, how do you know what your competitors are doing, both in order to hopefully drive up ambition and because you can see whether your competitors are acting or not, but also potentially to look at the comparability so that you can see and get a sense of, okay, is my competitor having a similar marginal abatement cost? Are they implementing in which sectors? That type of thing, so you can really get that picture. And finally, and all of those, ambition, equity, justice, and transparency and comparability, I would argue that you need a United Nations multilateral process or agreement to deal with. I don't see anywhere else that can do those things. So the G20 can't do that. The MEF can't do that. So I think the last function, in a way, is what about finance? And clearly the creation of the Green Fund in Cancun was a very important part of the outcome there. But clearly the UN is not the main body to be driving finance around the world. So the question for me there, is it more of a leveraging or coordination role? That does link in with equity. It does link in with justice, particularly around adaptation. So looking at that piece. There's then some functions around things like incentives. So technology cooperation, technology drive, trade, where I actually think that the UN is probably not the best place to be looking at those issues. They don't have the main actors in the room. The main actors are not governments often, obviously. They're corporations. So I think, looking in the bilateral relationships that go on or in coalition groupings that can come forward, I think those are important places to look. So while I agree that the question really is kind of what you've posed, is this multi-level of governance, right, from local to national to regional then to international, I guess my one reaction in your findings is there a second opportunity? If you had asked if Cancun had failed completely, then you would be in your second scenario, right? We would have been in complete fragmentation. There would have been no driver anymore. But Cancun, I would argue, was a moderate success. And so there are elements there that I think the paper slightly, in my view, underestimates what a UN framework convention can do. Not everything, so it's not the global deal, but if you look at some of these functions and what's now set up to occur, you have a science review around 2 degrees and 1.5, even taking into account observed impacts, which is new. You now have a process where all those pledges that came in going into Copenhagen are going to go into the agreement. There's going to be a process to clarify those assumptions and to link that in then with pretty detailed, but more details to be negotiated, transparency provisions both for developed and for developing countries. So whether that is accounting standards or not for developed countries, but certainly the whole transparency debate for developing countries. So those functions, and you have the Green Fund, which is linked in with equity and with justice. So how, in the next year you will see a lot of detailed negotiations there. That's not saying that the UN can do everything, but I think the other thing to really note is the key actors around the world, particularly developing countries, the the one reason I think that Cancun was a success is because that was at risk. If Cancun had failed, then it would not have been possible to even think about the UN Framework Convention having a central role anymore. That didn't happen. And that partially didn't happen because it's a very important thing for a number of actors, not only the small island developing states, but also for China, for India, for the major emerging actors. So on your recommendation, so I would just probably give a little bit more weight to that in your last scenario than we did. I think there is a question in how to pull that together with the bottom up. And my view is really, you know, you need that rulemaking to occur internationally, but we need to get action happening on the ground. The incentives need to be created through bilateral initiatives and national initiatives for low-carbon development to become the norm, that it is viewed as profitable, that it is viewed as meeting economic goals. I think China, one of the key pieces is making sure China succeeds in its 12th five-year plan. It's forging the way more than any other country. So supporting China in your recommendation about meeting its national target, I completely concur. The U.S. has the authority. We've done analysis. They can get 14% below 2005 levels by 2020 with a go-getter scenario, only with executive authorities. Need an aggressive administration there. And finally, for the EU, yes, on the coalition, they've started some of that with the Cartagena dialogue, but going to 30% is actually quite important because this is about the economics. I agree with that. And I think it's really moving it down to the national level. And if Europe moves to 30, because it is economically beneficial also from a trade perspective and from jobs perspective, that will help the evidence base both in the United States and globally. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Since you have alluded to the very important factor and role that that China is playing in all this, and also because the working group comprises participants of the U.S., the EU, and China, I would again like to go ladies first and ask the other Jennifer to perhaps share a couple of thoughts on China, but everything else as well.
I told them it was redundant because they had Jennifer here. At many levels of debt. But yeah, thanks so much for inviting me. It was an excellent report, I have to be honest. Never a fan of scenarios. But your scenarios were not these kind of la-la land things that I often see come across my desk. It was very accessible, very well-grounded, and I think that is an important thing to note. I'm an editor of publications. I like when things read well. Just so you know, that, I mean, I was also like, to, you know, your, you know, the recommendation about patchwork, I pointed to it and said, that's me. You know, I direct the China Environment Forum, which is, and some of the people in the room, I head the global mafia on China energy and environment. And I thought, ooh, I had a patchwork. I never thought of it that way. And in my work, I've been here 11 years working on the topic, you know, U.S.-China energy and environmental cooperation. And I've often felt that I was kind of below the radar in D.C. for like my first 6-7 years because, you know, the security and policy, you know, the big wigs never really paid attention to it. It was just kind of cute. But now it's, you know, the fact that I just had to run over here from the other Brookings meeting with the DOE where it's very exciting because in looking at, you know, U.S.-China energy cooperation and, you know, and to me, I just say energy and climate kind of they're overlapping there. I mean, over the years, it's been very ad hoc, underfunded. And, you know, I mean, the Congress doesn't appropriate money for the U.S. government to cooperate with China on these issues. The U.S. NGOs, you got your folks like WRI and the big dog green groups in town, I mean, they have really been, you know, kind of keeping the spirit alive, working with the Chinese, setting up concrete projects on the ground. And what's exciting, since November 2009 with the Obama-WHO agreements, there were agreements. It was quite exciting. And suddenly I'm getting all these calls and people want to know what's happening. And I've been doing a lot of meetings over the last year called cooperative competitors, right? Maybe the governments have to cooperate so there can be good, even, fair cooperation. So it's been a very optimistic time. But at the same time, you know, I have a publication out here that has, like, you know, the beautiful renewable energy, the wind towers, China's green revolution, and we are excited. China is being very aggressive on low carbon. There are challenges, and there are a lot of people working with them on that. But what I see is kind of a scary trend, and you kind of touch on it in your report, too, about kind of the public opinion of, you know, you talk about public opinion of climate, the public doesn't get it. Well, in many ways, like in the States, there's a big opinion, well, it's the Chinese, right? You know, I was giving a talk out in Fargo, North Dakota, and I had local environmental folks come to me and saying, we're trying to do advocacy on climate change, and people are always coming up to me, and the farmers in North Dakota are yelling at me about the Chinese, right? So it's a big challenge because, one of your recommendations was that the NGOs, the civil society, can play this role on educating the people about the UN Plus approach. But I hate to say it, but in some ways, can we say, has the NGO community succeeded in convincing people about climate change? But then again, maybe if you shift it more towards, these local initiatives, the bottom up, and seeing the success, that can be helpful. But again, another thing back to the U.S.-China. China's success, now the talk is China stealing the jobs. But then the fact, though, because there have been reports, and I've been talking to a lot of smart people in my network, like renewable energy. It doesn't matter that a wind turbine is made in China. If you install it here, 75% of the jobs are here. And there's kind of like messages like that don't seem to be getting out on, the advantages of working together. But again, what's exciting is that, over there at the Mandarin Oriental with all the high-level folks, but also there are a lot of Chinese and U.S. researchers and NGOs kind of talking about how they could move forward this clean energy cooperation. And I have to say, I don't know, I think I'm a born optimist, but I'm feeling a lot more optimistic now. That I think that if it can be consistent, notably, the formal bilateral agreements are all, they can change in time. Congress may not fund it. But the one piece that I think could be a model for, when we're thinking about other bilaterals, the clean energy research centers. I don't know if any of you heard of them. Part of the Obama agreement saying that the U.S. and China will work together on electric vehicles, carbon capture and sequestration, and am I spacing it? The third one. Clean coal. Cleaner coal. That's the thing, clean coal. But what's interesting about that model, and in some ways it embodies your patchwork idea, is that it has NGOs, businesses, and government folks working together on the topic. And I'm going to be doing more meetings over this year because I'm just now trying to find out who the Chinese side is. You guys are involved in one. They're in the green building one. So I think that could be something that as you move forward, looking to some more models like that, that are actually bringing the private sector in, and not just the U.S. private sector, Chinese private sector, big entrepreneurs. I'm going to zip because I'm kind of like random all over the map here, and for some more consistency to talk about urbanization, I think you're going to.
What wonderful transition. I don't have to say anything. Please, Stephen, it would be great to hear a little bit of a different take, I assume.
I have a very different take on things. My first job out of university was working for the sanitation department in New York City. It was the agency that many people considered to be the garbage fairy because every night you put stuff out on the curb and poof, it's gone by the morning and it goes somewhere. And that speaks to kind of a different set of responsibilities and policy issues that you think about when you're dealing at this sub-national level. And as I'm listening to these presentations by very articulate people who think very great thoughts, I think, God, I just worry about, is the garbage going to be taken away tomorrow? And in terms of who I talk to, how quickly will the building permit be issued by this agency? Is it going to be a green permit, or is it going to be something that allows a browner building to be constructed? When you take all these issues down to the operating level, where decisions have to be made, it gets really messy. And I have a hard time today deciding, am I going to be optimistic or am I going to be pessimistic? Because I can speak to either side very, very easily and at length. I've spent a lot of the last year working on these issues in China, running a training program, a technical assistance program for local authorities across China. It's known as the Energy Smart Cities Initiative. It was run by an NGO known as JUICE. We parallel other initiatives that were run by the Climate Group, by WWF, by the Institute for Sustainable Communities. WRI is involved in some of these initiatives. All of them are trying to help local authorities in China who are hungry for information and ideas. We bring supposedly best practice ideas from the West, but then we also try and contextualize them to understand how this stuff might fit in China. Will it fit in China? We're not presenting thou shalt ideas. It's please consider ideas. Or tell us what you're doing that's better than this already. because we'd like to bring that idea back home. And so the one nice thing that I can speak to is that there is already a plethora of these kinds of initiatives going on around the world. In the 12th five-year plan, you're seeing low-carbon cities mentioned. And you're seeing mayors from China get up in public forums and say the word low-carbon city. They're not quite certain what it means. They're not quite certain how they're going to get there, but they now know that central government wants them to create a lower carbon city than what they have right now. And so that's a good thing. Clear messaging, that's beginning to take effect. The challenge comes when we begin to think about this thing, and I appreciate the direction you're heading, and I think we're in this patchwork situation right now. We're kind of, we've been working in that approach for some time. 2020 is a really hard time frame to try and get this stuff done. Ask a mayor of New York City where the Second Avenue subway line has been talked about for over 60 years how quickly he can build a new subway line. And he's going to say, well, actually, it's not my responsibility. It's this other regional government agency that has to take responsibility for that. Not my deal. One of the challenges we get when we start thinking about these issues is who actually has this responsibility? Is it the mayor? Is it a regional transportation agency? Is it a state-level agency that might actually have the funding? How much of it is on you that you need to take up some of these price signals that have been offered up by the markets, by different governmental bodies to take action? How many of you got in a car today? Okay, me too, hybrid, but not when I got to Washington. So what is it going to take? What kind of price signal is it going to take to get me out of that car, to have gotten me onto the metro, to then have made me walk a few blocks to get here? Maybe a congestion pricing scheme. Maybe that'll convince more people, fewer cars, to change our behavior. Congestion pricing was only allowed in London because of an act of parliament. Central government had to sanction local government to take action. Local governments are creatures of the state. They can only do what central government says they can do. Mayor Bloomberg couldn't move congestion pricing forward in New York City because the state refused to act. Federal government money was put on the table. The state legislature refused to take action. Congestion pricing died. It may come back now because we're in a very different budget scenario in New York City. And this may be a new way to get some money on the table for interesting transportation initiatives. In the case of buildings, again, this is an area where perhaps local government can take a lot of action. But, again, what's it going to take to get you, the building owner or the building tenant, to take action? Is the mayor the best person to make that happen? Are you going to believe the mayor more than you're going to believe an NGO? Are you going to believe the market more than you're going to believe government? Are you only going to do it until there is a tax break that's sizable? There was $1,500 on the table last year to do energy efficiency upgrades. Did I do it? No. Okay, I'm a minority here. I'm sorry. What is it going to take to move us? And who is really best situated to take that action? Okay, I'm going to stop being pessimistic. I'm going to talk more about the good news that's out there. Yes, the C40 exists, and there is now competition created by local authorities to begin doing more and more and to share information. That's a great thing. In the EU, the Covenant of Mayors is similarly helping local authorities understand how they could do the kinds of stuff that you're saying. Take the big ideas and bring it down to the ground level, and help you make the decisions that we need to have happen if we're going to make progress on any of these ultimate targets. In the U.S., we have the block grant program. Interesting situation. Authorized by an Energy Policy Act of 2007, not funded until 2009. So Congress acted, Congress acted, and then they didn't act. They didn't fund the program. And then you have to question, well, realistically, how much money should be going to individual cities? What type of activities are they investing in? Do we want to fund planning or do we want to fund implementation? I can shut up, don't worry. Tokyo is establishing a carbon market focused on the city of Tokyo. Forget this big global carbon market stuff. Forget Reggie. Tokyo is doing this. Who else is going to follow on from what Tokyo is doing in that regard? Very interesting question. It's the operationalization of all of these ideas that I think about on a regular basis, that mayors are thinking about on a regular basis, and that if I encourage you to do one thing, it's to try and pay attention to what local authorities are doing out there, but then you have to ask yourself a good question. Am I satisfied with the pace of implementation? Am I satisfied with the level of ambition? And are we actually doing the stuff that's going to get us down to the 450, back down to the 350 parts per million? Or did they just pick some number out of the sky that really ain't going to get us where we need to go? Thanks.
Thank you very much. I think I made a good call taking you, Stephen, taking you last, because you delivered exactly what I wanted to set up the discussion, and that is given two things. One is the vivid description of the enormous dynamic that is going on in terms of bottom-up approaches, especially in cities, and this dynamic is, I think, was the glimmer of hope that also the working group moved along and helped the work very much, and now is central to the report. And what you also did is talk a little bit about the limitations of this, about the limitations of what is called the patchwork approach in the report, and that is basically the point where the working group is also at now, to find ways to how do we do it? How can we scale up? How can we make this work and take this dynamic that is inevitably there and make it count? With that, I would like to open the discussion to the room. I'm going to have a slight bias towards the members of the working group for a first couple of comments, if they may, or we're going to go right ahead and take questions from the room, and I'm going to distribute the questions to either of you or members of the working group as I see fit. Please. Perhaps you can identify yourself quickly. And
Sure. Thanks. I'm Lisa Friedman. I'm with ClimateWire. Thanks for doing this. This is really interesting. And my question goes back to the point that Jennifer made about the collective ambition. One of the things I think it was that Andre said that really struck me was that the United States has dozens of state and local initiatives, and that we're a leader in these. You know, the I mean, it has not had an impact on the United States emissions, and so if we're entering a period where we are doing pledge and review, countries are doing pledge and review, and if we're entering a period where we're relying on a patchwork set of local and industry initiatives, for both the folks who wrote the report and maybe some of the experts who are involved in the negotiations, what is the plan for making sure that we stay below 450? Do we just assume, do we hope that countries see once they start working that, gee, it's not as hard or as costly as we thought, and they go beyond that ambition? Because the scenarios that exist now from WRI and others say that the pledges in the Copenhagen Accord don't take us far enough. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
We're going to collect a couple perhaps there.
Thank you. Julia Clonis, I'm an economist working on development and focusing on environmental and gender issues. I would appreciate an explanation by the first panelist about the recommendation of focusing on economic issues away from environmental and social issues. Somehow I see an oxymoron there, because you have come a long way of realizing that economic issues, environmental issues, social policy issues, or lack of policy thereof have economic impacts. How can you, could you tell me what exactly do you mean by separating economic from environmental and social policies or lack of policies? Thank you.
Please.
Hi, thank you. Kate Cicis from the Peace Center on Global Climate Change. Thank you very much for the report. I think we're also all doing policy scenario options, particularly after Copenhagen, a little more optimism after Cancun. And I like Jennifer's framing, Jennifer Morgan, and Jennifer Turner, of course, but Jennifer Morgan's framing about, you know, about the functions, and we do need to be careful about, you know, ambition and something to tie this together. And but we are in a bottom-up world now, I think, and the approach of companies and cities and everybody working together is going to be very important. And one thing I wanted to touch on and to get the authors to explain a little bit more is the role of sectoral agreements. Mm-hmm. It's a very dirty word in the in the UN context, but if we are going in these different directions, I think whether your sectoral agreements focused on sort of companies getting together across borders, or whether you're talking about countries getting together across borders with particular sectors.
Take one more.
Hi, I'm Jane Siegel with the U.S. Department of Commerce. I work in the commercial service with the senior energy advisor. I wanted to say something about patches. I think that's a good sort of heuristic device, and it should maybe have more legs. I think when I see all of the programs that I'm aware of and one that I work with, a couple that I work with, they seem to be isolated patches, but it would maybe be worthwhile for the working group to look at how those patches can spread and grow. I thought of contagion, which is has a negative connotation. I don't mean that, but spread, how it spreads. So, for example, the we work with the League of Green Embassies, which has recently been taken over, the head of it, by Ambassador Bruce Orrick, who is absolutely determined to implement, on the embassy side, President Obama's Executive Order 13514, which is that all U.S. government properties need to be greened. In short, I want to take, you can look it up. He's the ambassador, U.S. ambassador to Finland, and has gotten several millions of dollars, 80, I think, to knock down an annex at the embassy and rebuild to LEED platinum certification. That is a demonstration project, and he is interesting other local governments who have buildings that contain millions of metric square feet. That's an example of contagion. We're trying to make that work because that's an export and that's what we do. One other story of contagion I really must tell is a company, a tiny company in California, which has a technology that takes Montreal Protocol gases and kills them, destroys them. They earn credits under California's law. Emissions trading law, which had a near-death experience but survived in the summer. The credits they earned in June were worth nothing, and now, or at least in December when we spoke to them, they're worth $8 a credit. These are small steps. These are the patches, but they have the – what is the potential for these patches to spread and grow, which I think would be a good project for the group.
Excellent, excellent. Thanks for this. I see the working group busily taking notes. It's all going to go into the second version then of the report. I heard two questions that I would like to give back to the panel. The one on the focus on economic issues, I think that I will be happy to answer, and on collective ambitions, the first question to Jennifer, and the other questions or comments on the importance of sectoral agreements and more generally making patchwork governance contagious, I think the group will be happy to say something on. Perhaps you start.
Sure. So let me give you an example of the negotiating history that I think has not served the process or the environment well. So the Kyoto Protocol largely lists the emissions targets of its participants as emissions reductions relative to some historical base year, in most cases 1995 emissions. So after that, many countries felt that any subsequent discussion of commitments had to be framed in terms of departures from 1995 emissions. The problem with that is that different countries are growing in the baseline much differently, or had grown much differently from each other since 1995. So two countries with the same target of X percent below 1995 emissions could have embedded in those commitments very, very different levels of economic effort that were required to achieve those targets. So the result of all of this is that an insistence that we had to negotiate around a certain kind of formula for emissions, because the economics were so different. You were in this conundrum. You either had to have targets that looked very different but had about the same economic effort, or you had to have targets that looked the same but actually embodied very different levels of economic effort. And this conundrum persisted for years after the Kyoto Protocol was negotiated in 1997. And I think all that discussion distracted from the actual fact that we need to reduce emissions relative to baseline. And every country has a different baseline. So any effort to try to formulate things in exactly the same terms just complicated the negotiations. So what we're arguing is that, okay, make it a little simpler. Let countries negotiate directly on the effort they're willing to put in. I mean, ultimately, that's sort of the political viability test of the policy you're trying to adopt, right? So if countries can know what the economic burden of their commitment is, then they might be more likely to take one. And they might be actually more willing to take a tighter target than they otherwise might, because they have some certainty as to the economic burden associated with it. Now, remember, for every environmental commitment, there's an economic outcome. For every economic outcome, there's an environmental level of performance. So by shifting the negotiations to the economic burden, it doesn't mean that I'm somehow divorcing the negotiations from environmental performance. What I'm trying to do is to get an agreement, which we haven't had yet. I mean, if you insist that the only possible kind of commitment has to be a target, then I think you're disallowing a flexibility. In fact, we actually saw this. I think we moved a long way in Copenhagen, because now countries can choose their own base year. Wow, what a radical idea. And some countries even chose their own framework of target, emissions per unit GDP. So that kind of flexibility in formulating commitments, I think, can foster agreement and actually ultimately be better for the environment, because you actually get somewhere instead of being locked in this what I have seen as very unfruitful dynamic about the looks of a commitment as opposed to its actual performance. Does that help? I hope it helps.
Just one quick response. I mean, I think we do have an agreement, though. We have a continuation on the Kyoto Protocol, and there's not an agreement there. But basically what countries agreed in Cancun was to take the pledges, which are economy-wide targets for Annex I countries, and different kinds of nationally appropriate mitigation actions from developing countries, list them in an information document as a decision, and now to clarify it, because there isn't a lot of information about what those targets and actions actually mean. So nobody knows what's in that 17% box for the U.S., and nobody knows what's in the BAU for a number of countries. And that process, in some ways, is there's a formulaic answer to your question, Lisa, and then there's the way things work in the real world. I think that it's the core question that you're asking, because we know the gap between the Copenhagen pledges or the Cancun agreements and staying below 2 degrees is massive and growing. We know from the UNEP gap report that the accounting rules and how that all comes together matters, And so you have a science review that's in there that has to happen by 2015. You have to, you know, clarify these targets. And I don't think that's going to go away. I think that will keep the international pressure on it. I think transparency is one part of the answer. WRI has just launched something called the Open Climate Network. We've brought together top institutes from all major economies in the world to track their country's implementation for civil society engagement. But I also think it's about the pace of innovation. We have to accelerate the pace of innovation, and that gets to when you're funding technology, cooperation, and transfer, are you funding incremental change or are you funding innovation so that that pathway happens more quickly, because that has to occur in the real world, and that race to the future that comes through. That's one of the things that we'll actually track, is which countries are winning that low-carbon race. And that gets to the one of your recommendations on the border tax adjustments in the EU. Because I think at the end of the day, it has to be economically profitable to move to a low-carbon world. And there are low-cost, no-cost things that can get, or quick turnarounds that will get you part of the way there, but lots of barriers to doing them. But until, you know, there is a situation where a country really believes that moving to low-carbon is in their benefit, and if they don't, that there will be a penalty, and that gets into a link of, you know, if you're not looking, if you're in a pledge and review world without a compliance or enforcement mechanism, these border adjustments and trade could start to become that enforcement, right? That's, you know, and so I think linking those different pieces in your work would be very interesting. Highly challenging, highly political, not a bit, you know, I'm not out there saying this is what needs to happen. But I think you've put your finger on that, and Lisa, I think that links in with the ambition question as well.
I'm a PhD student at Oxford University in my day job. I wanted to thank you all again, both panelists and members of the audience, for coming today. Your questions and the responses of the panelists have really helped to, I think, put a sharp point on our thinking and what we need to do next. And I think one of the key issues that both sets of questions and the responses brought up is that we're kind of trying to confront a very fundamental mismatch here between what is happening, as many people have highlighted, on local levels at all, but also trying to take a global view of these low-level approaches. And a lot of what I think we're trying to wrestle with is how we create the architecture to, there's a phrase that I like a lot when talking about issues like governance, which is to figure out how you can have institutions that add effectiveness at the margins to what a lot of people on the ground are already doing. And I think that's in many ways kind of the crux of what we're trying to figure out. And I think, again, the responses and the questions have helped us to kind of at least made me realize that the crux seems to be how you differentiate responsibilities between all levels of actors. I think that's the kind of crux of the governance issue. Mr. Hammer, you mentioned that cities can only do what states allow them to do. And I think it's a perfect example of how we need to kind of lay out these responsibilities at various levels. And I think what one of the things we're trying to get at is that we need rules that apply at all levels and to all players in the game, not just nation states and not just at the multilateral level, but at all different levels. I wanted to quickly offer, and this is a direct answer to the two questions, I think, about the putting legs on the patchwork scenario, for an example of how we thought that might work out. And I'd certainly be interested in particular responses to this, but also just as a general example, which is in the case of the United States building on Clean Air Act regulatory authority that exists to mandate states either in individually or in combination to develop some sort of clean climate and energy strategy, which might prioritize things like green jobs or energy security in different combinations, but nonetheless have some baseline mandate to address climate and energy issues. So that's just a kind of more concrete example about the ways in which we thought that these responsibilities, these rules, might be allocated to all levels of government and all the players in the game, rather than just focusing up at the apex.
And to speak very quickly to the sectoral issue,
we think there's a lot of potential here. In aviation, there's a lot of progress that's been made to making planes emit less carbon into the atmosphere. There's also successful examples of other kinds of environmental regulations that have been dealt with at a sectoral level. The chemical industry's safety standards, for example, were negotiated under the threat of regulation, but by the industry itself. And those are the kinds of things that we think might be effective for certain kinds of industries, things where you have a small number of players who have a large capacity to make these agreements themselves. The advantage of doing it sectorally, as opposed to doing it at the firm level or even the industry level, is to remove the competitive fears that that companies might have about taking ambitious measures themselves. If you do it yourself, your competitor might eat your lunch. But if everyone sits down and agrees to move at the same time, those kinds of agreements can just shift the industry as a whole without disrupting the market share that each company has.
Yeah, hi. My name is Kenneth Rothschild. I'm just an independent person just attending this. First, I really admire you for this presentation and taking this on. This is an extremely, extremely difficult problem. And it's very representative of where our culture, the world and locally, are stuck right now. Basically, my belief is we're structured in a totally inappropriate world to deal with the public problems that are going to confront us. And this is only going to accelerate through our lifetimes. So my points that I wanted to raise, and actually they've been somewhat raised already, I think the economic thing is very important, as you spoke about. I think we have to develop some metrics to actually break this down into a comprehensible way for both the average person and for policy people. I think we need metrics for sustainability, and we need that on a personal level, and we need that on a larger level too. Right now, the world is focused on growth, but really that's part of our problem. We're screwing ourselves up. I think we have to look at population and lifestyle, how that's going to affect the individual, how that's going to affect the community, and I think that includes looking at distribution of wealth and income. So basically, to just summarize, I think we've got to focus on transition, because the rough road now is if we can see goals and we can put them out there, but at the same time, we have to develop transitional systems that can make sure that, as the first speaker mentioned, the hurt doesn't go to one side of the community while the other side thrives. And finally, I'd just say I would appreciate some identification of the barriers, specific corporations. I mean, you're not going to be able to name everybody. But the fact of the matter is private industry really controls the reins of both governing and the economy. And I think we've got to start to look at that and identify some specifics so that this isn't a sort of nameless thing. And it's not a matter of just pure guilt, but it's a matter of bringing it down into understandable confrontations that are going to be real and how we're going to deal with those confrontations. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sakura Namioka, I'm an urban planner. And I like to sort of repeat that the gentleman said. I hear if you read the newspaper, you see very prominent person, he doesn't believe climate change. And once I was told that they never use the word green, it's so elitism. But I think everybody agrees with energy saving, saving water, clean air, that kind of stuff. So I think it needs something to do each ordinary citizen can understand, but also each ordinary citizen can participate to do something. 2-3 weeks ago, there was a New York Times article. There was Midwest farmers. They just do not believe climate change or anything, but they are absolutely for energy saving, something like that.
Hi. Andrew Holland with the International Institute for Strategic Studies. I wanted to go back to the scenarios that were in the report here, the first, second, and third. The first being the Kyoto 2.0, and I've noticed it in a lot of reports and a lot of things recently that the ultimate goal should be completing Kyoto or building on Kyoto. But I think something that's lost often in this is that Kyoto is largely failed as a treaty. It has not reached its it hasn't brought down carbon emissions at all. The only country is that's going to meet its emissions targets is the EU. Canada is 40% over. The United States obviously didn't join. So I guess my point may be that it's the UN plus approach could actually be more effective than the Kyoto 2.0 approach. So maybe look at it through that way, and instead of saying the be-all and end-all is a new Kyoto. So.
Excellent. Thanks a lot. That last question is actually a question that was heatedly debated within the group, and I think we're going to have to say something about that. Since no question on China has been raised so far, and I cannot let that stand, I'm going to have one question for Jennifer Turner. The one of the recommendations we came up with is to use or to follow the model tradition of experimentation and provincial differentiation of policies within China to use as a model for climate change as well, to have different parts of China, provinces, province level, or cities move ahead, give them more leeway, and move ahead on their own green ambitions. I think we discussed that quite a bit. And I think it's an interesting premise, and I would love to hear from you how you see that, how possible and how feasible that kind of internal differentiation in China might be, and also how possible it is to link that to international networks and even to firmer commitments on an inter-regional level. So perhaps I give the confrontations. The first questions I think I give to Stephen, who might have to say a little bit about that.
Because he's so confrontational.
No, because it, I think it speaks directly to a couple of things
it
that
does,
he has raised.
Okay. Con Edison is the incumbent utility for the city, serving the city of New York and Westchester County. They've had essentially the exclusive service franchise for the last 100 years. I'm a building owner, and I would like to install a piece of equipment known as a combined heat and power system to provide power and thermal energy, heating and cooling, for my building. I have to go ask permission of Con Edison to plug in, to interconnect to their system, because typically the way it works out is I'll never size the system so it satisfies all of my needs. Con Edison has the right to impose all kinds of technical restrictions that are going to drive up the cost, increase my permitting costs, increase my consulting costs, that may actually make it infeasible. They also have the right to charge a tariff that has been agreed to by the state. There's a separate tariff for the steam system, there's a separate tariff for the gas system, and there's a separate tariff for the electric system. I may make a different decision based on whether I'm on a block that's served by the Con Ed steam system or not. Is Con Edison to blame? Or is the state regulator to blame for this situation? I have a really hard time answering that question because Con Edison is the one who I, the building owner, am going to have to deal with most of the time. But they essentially can come right back to me and say, go appeal to the state regulator. We brought our information to the state. They agreed to our tariff structure, to our permitting structure. Blame them. Don't blame me. You also have to take into account the fact that how right is it that I'm a building owner, I want to do the right thing in my building. But what if I screw it up? And what if that means I blow out the system for everybody on my block or everybody in my neighborhood? I bring down the grid in my neighborhood for a day, a week, a month. Does Con Edison, are they obliged to protect everybody's interests, their shareholders' interests, or are they obliged to let me plug in because I'm trying to be green? It's a very messy question when I say, is a corporation being an obstacle in this situation? Because in many times, government is very complicit in this decision-making. They create the rules in which many of these corporations act. Now I'm going to give you a different scenario, and then I'll be quiet. I'm an electric vehicle manufacturer, and I just want to sell cars. I want to sell a lot of green cars. I want to sell plug-in stations around Manhattan. I need to work with the utility. I need the buying public. But all of a sudden, Mayor Bloomberg says, I would love you to have your green car, but I don't want too many cars in Midtown, period. I want everybody in public transportation. Is it the car companies? Are they at fault for trying to conduct business to sell what many of us would agree is a good thing? But the mayor is also looking out for, how do I prevent traffic congestion from bringing the city and bringing economic activity around the city to a crawl? Is the corporation good or evil in that regard? I have a hard time answering your question because I can play both sides of that card very, very easily.
Perhaps the group wants to say something about one versus three. What's going to be more effective?
Yeah, I'll say something to that. I'm Tobias from Berlin, also part of the group. We've discussed that at length, actually, which scenario we think would be most effective or the best for the planet, of course. And I think it's hard to say at this point. When we designed these scenarios or thought about them using the methodology, we tried to make them as extreme as possible to make them different. And our Kyoto 2.0 scenario is, of course, a scenario where it goes much beyond the Kyoto Protocol that we know from history. It's a new protocol that includes many more countries and that actually has teeth, which the Kyoto Protocol did not have. And that's the reason why, of course, the change in global carbon emissions is very small compared to the initial ambitions. So the optimal scenario for us would still be scenario one, but that would go much beyond the Kyoto, original Kyoto Protocol. And we actually think that, of course, the reality, and we've heard that today in the questions and also from the panel, is an overlap of the different scenarios somewhere in between. We already see some of the patchwork governance emerging. We also see saw some success, albeit small, in Cancun, which, again, gives us a little more hope maybe for scenario one. And as Thomas mentioned at the beginning, also there is no reason to believe that we can't get from scenario three in the end to scenario one. It just won't happen by 2020. And we've heard also today that 2020 is a very, very, very short time frame. But it could well be that once we have this governance, patchwork governance or governance network in place, then 10 or 20 years later, that actually can muster the global support and actually create the expertise and the trust in the system that finally we can get some functioning global treaty that actually will create what we need. I think that's just one little comment, if I may, that I want to make about this as well. Regarding that the idea behind the patchwork governance, why we think it is actually so interesting and so important. The real big questions that we've raised for ourselves and that we also haven't found answers to is, how can we actually make this happen? How can we get from the state that we've heard today that it's already happening, there's a lot of initiatives going on, we've heard some stories, some examples, to a point where those actually add up, where they do make a difference. Before we had the question, in the US we have a lot of bottom-up approaches, but still carbon emissions are rising. Well, they would have risen probably more than they actually have, but we haven't measured it. We can't put a number to it. We don't have any monitoring capacity. We don't account for it. We can't add it up. So we have all these local initiatives, and then we have the global discussion at the UN, but the linkage in between is missing. And Jennifer Morgan has just given us an example of where maybe how these linkages could look like. And we believe if we want to make scenario three work, the Patrick scenario, we need to work on these linkages, and we don't have enough knowledge. We need to know how we can bring different actors together, how we can create monitoring capacity, how we can create new fora, but also how we can add teeth to that, to make that actually something that really changes the outcome in the end, which is the only thing that's really important, is the global carbon emissions, of course.
Just quickly, I think when you're just looking at your Kyoto scenario and also thinking about whether to include it or I think it's important to do a little bit of history as to why it has failed to reduce global emissions. And I don't think it's because of the treaty itself. I think it's because the United States and the Bush administration didn't ratify it. So, and there were reasons for that. Those were the domestic debate. Climate is economics is domestic. But the original plans of the protocol were to have, there was an Article 10 proposed in Kyoto to include major emerging economies. That would have been the next step. Canada would have been in a very different position if there had been domestic implementation in the United States. So we can do revisionist history, but I don't think it's the treaty. It's the politics around this issue that make it so challenging of combining policy and politics on the international level and then on these national levels in a way and combine them that they actually get you to your outcome. So I think everybody but Canada will meet their targets. They'll buy through the carbon market, so you did get the carbon market there. But I just think it's important to kind of unpack that a little bit. And I actually would include a Kyoto scenario. I would put a low probability, high impact one, which is slightly different than what you have, which would be to have everybody move forward with an amended Kyoto Protocol except the United States. I would think you would put the U.S. in a decision under the convention, and the world would recognize that getting an international treaty ratified through the U.S. Senate is a highly improbable event and would be willing to accept that they would be integrated in the regime, docked in, but not have that ratification threshold. Highly improbable, would require massive incentives, I think, for China to move forward under a binding treaty without the U.S. there. But it is in discussion amongst various folks, and I think it's probably more probable than trying to move everybody into a binding treaty. I think that's possible before 2020, but I just throw it out there for a little wrinkle.
Thank you. Perhaps, Jennifer, a little bit on the potential of giving provinces in China more freedom to use to move on their own speed.
Well, I mean, you know, Beijing doesn't really control things in China. You got to toss that idea out of your mind. But, you know, but taking a step back, you know, your initial question was saying that, you know, that you want the provincial governments to maybe get more, you know, the low carbon initiatives to be linked to the international world. Yeah. But that's how it happened. I mean, since 1990, you have your Energy Foundation, some bilateral aid, international NGOs. You know, they've really been the capacity builders, both on the policy front. I mean, the fingerprints of international organizations are all over the clean energy laws in China. And then, you know, particularly, you know, while people tend to look at, you know, the question about patchwork, you have all these small initiatives that maybe, you know, how do you make them grow? But I think, you know, we could be getting more to critical mass. And also when you link with that, the COHOW, the nice big slogan now about low carbon, right? Right now I would say it is a low carbon. There is no real low carbon city yet in China. But I do think it's a good point that they are talking about it. And that, you know, that so there's been a lot of top-down pressure, and they did reach their energy intensity goals, right? But I've been hearing from some Chinese that they're at a kind of a fragile stage because they've lost a lot of – it took a lot of political power to make that happen. But I think, though, that now what – you know, maybe a sign of hope, not that the, you know, business rides in on the silver horse to save the day. But when you look at the number of international companies going to China, you know, of course, losing jobs in the U.S. Forget that for a minute. But that the number of – you know, going to China as the laboratory, right, for carbon capture and sequestration, renewable energy – the list goes on and on. And, you know, I mean, I think that matters because today when I was over at, you know, the DOE Brookings event over there with the government folk and everyone talking, saying that, you know, we need to scale this stuff up. And in China, you know, they could be the laboratory. But China, the Chinese entrepreneurs, they're not just sitting there like waiting, we will be the lab for the world. They're looking at this, we can get this technology and we're going to go overseas. I mean, there's been some interesting partnerships between U.S. and Chinese companies, like one up in Pennsylvania. They're building a IGCC plant, right? It's carbon capture sequestration ready. And so I had these guys come and talk at my forum, and I said, well, this is great. There's jobs in Pennsylvania being formed from all this. What's next? They said, well, it's never going to work in the U.S. because you don't have the policy, so we're going to go, this U.S.-Chinese partnership, and we're going to go to Eastern Europe and Latin America. You know, so it's kind of, I mean, it will lower carbon emissions somewhere. And I think that that's a really kind of an encouraging development as well that, okay, you know, it's everyone saying like, yeah, U.S. doesn't have the market, but they know that, you know, there's the innovation maybe on our end, and they've, you know, it's a combination of coming together, and so that's another piece. My optimism is just probably really putting you off here again, isn't it? But I mean, you know, again, it's not solving everything. There's a lot of governance problems, but I think, though, that there are going to be some pockets of innovation in China, and that they do, you know, the central government, top down, but they are at this experimentation stage. The only problem is sometimes they see one that works and they try to make that go for everyone. But no, there's a lot of exciting innovation, and I'm seeing a lot of the international partners kind of moving more They're kind of done with talking with Beijing. They're going to the grassroots, like you guys. You're in Guangdong and Jiangsu province now. Who knew that WI would go to the ground?
Excellent. I'm not sure. I think we're going to wrap up now. And I want to again thank the panelists very, very much for their input, very valuable for the work of the working group, and also for the very thoughtful questions from the audience. I think we have gotten what we kind of lured all of you to do here. And thank you very much for this.